Woodstock was not, to me, the beginning of the change. It was the tombstone. It was the end of the change. By that point, that change had been completely accomplished. I mean, by 1968, almost everybody on campus, yours truly excepted, was wearing tie-dyed, bell-bottomed everything with Indian Madras tunics and homemade sandals and love beads and God knows what. It was, to my mind, absolutely the worst period for clothing and music that has ever existed in the history of mankind. But that's just me.
That's Bruce Boyer, and the end he's talking about was not the end of civilization. Well, not completely. It was the end of Ivy League clothes. The end of college students wearing tweed jackets, chinos, button-down shirts, and penny loafers. The end of elegance. And Bruce knows. He was there. He saw it happen. This is Unbuttoned, G. Bruce Boyer's Life in Clothes, Chapter 1. Unbuttoned is brought to you by Shibumi Firenze. Shibumi stocks some of Italy's finest accessories, all carefully selected by owner Benedict Fries.
I discovered his online store just by accident. I just came across it. And it kind of stunned me because it was a very small selection, but everything seemed perfect to me. They had some rep type regimental ties, but they were all perfect. You know, all the right color combinations and everything. So I ordered two ties.
Discover Shibumi Firenze for yourself at shibumi-firenze.com. Use the offer code UNBUTTONED for 10% off. I'm Pedro Mendez, and I started wearing and loving Ivy League clothes pretty recently. But you don't see much of it anymore. Certainly not like in the photos of American college campuses from the 50s and 60s. But what was it really like? In this episode, Bruce takes us back to his start in clothes, and how the Ivy League look became his look, the style he stuck with for six decades.
When I went to high school, I was from this blue-collar neighborhood on the south side of town, so we came in wearing peg pants and, you know, black leather jackets. But there were kids from what was the west end of town, the wealthier part of town, who came wearing Ivy League clothes. And I remember when I first saw those guys wearing the button-down shirts and the Harris tweed jackets, I said, that's it. So I went home and burned all of my old clothes. Where I grew up and where I still live in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, there was a huge college population. And so every town all had Ivy League shops, campus shops. In Allentown, the place was called Gentry. In Bethlehem, it was called Tiger Hall. And in Easton, it was called the London Shop. And all three places were absolutely chock-a-block with, you know, button-down shirts and tweed jackets and Shetland crewneck sweaters and khakis and gray flannels and stuff like that. And they could explain what it was about. They knew the fabrics. They knew, you know, how it was made and everything like that. So it was really educational. I suppose that was really what I would call my postgraduate work, because I would ask questions. You know, I would go into those stores even when I wasn't buying anything. You know, I would just go in and I would pester them. You know, I would say, well, what do you call this fabric, and how is this made, and why does this work like this, and how is this done, and how is this worn, how would you wear this tie with, you know, what would you wear it with, and that kind of thing. And I frequented all of those shops. In fact, I think I paid the rent on all three of those places.
Now, before we get much deeper into Bruce's conversion to Ivy League, I suppose you need a better idea of just what Ivy League is. You might be thinking preppy, like those 1980s polo shirts with popped collars, which I remember so vividly from high school. But the movement goes all the way back to the 1920s. That's when students on campuses all around the U.S., not just at Ivy League schools, were the vanguard of menswear. They introduced relaxed and sporty clothes into more formal situations. Like they would wear colorful Fair Isle sweaters and tweeds from Scottish country life, but in the city and at school. They wore sports shirts, like button-downs, with ties and suits. They challenged the conventional norms of footwear by wearing slip-on loafers. In many ways, these upper middle-class Americans were trying to look like rich British lords or sportsmen. And along the way, they developed this idea that clothes that were much more relaxed, even a bit schleppy, suggested nonchalance. The nonchalance of old money. If your shirt collar started to fray or your jacket elbows needed patching, that proved that you had been dressing like this for years. In fact, when the Ivy look started to become a national trend in Bruce's day, some students even sandpapered the collars of their button-downs to give them that worn-in casual look, the pre-torn jeans of their day. Now that we've got that straight, back to Bruce. Other than those rich kids at school, who else inspired him to not only dress well, but dress Ivy?
My uncles were all wonderful dressers. They were, by and large, professional men. I had four uncles, and three of them were physicians. So they usually wore suits and ties, and they bought very good clothing because they could afford it. And they bought, I wouldn't say, you know, fashionable clothing, but they bought stylish clothing, you know, good quality and so forth. And they would wear, you know, nice suits and nice sport jackets and ties. And even when they dressed down, they would wear, you know, well-cut gabardine slacks and good quality penny loafers and nice sport jackets and that kind of thing. So I was kind of surrounded by people who wore quality clothing. And I think the lesson that I really took away from that was that you should always buy the best you can afford. Buy fewer clothes, but buy the best you can afford. Because what I noticed about my uncles was that even when their, let's say their shoes were old, because they would wear them for years, they looked terrific. Whereas a lot of guys that I knew in my blue-collar neighborhood, they bought cheap shoes, which didn't even look that great when they were new and certainly didn't look good when they were old and didn't last that long. So it seemed to me that buying good quality was both less expensive in the long run and it tended to look better. So I kind of said to myself ever since, I can't afford to buy cheap clothing.
And it wasn't just fellow students and his family that were early influences on Bruce. Foreshadowing his future career in fashion, as a teenager, Bruce learned some invaluable lessons working part-time in a men's clothing store.
The guy who owned the store was an absolute brilliant salesman. He would do anything to sell you something, including locking the door and not letting you out of the shop. I mean, he was. I could not believe some of the stuff that he pulled on customers. It was outrageous. I mean, I couldn't watch it. I was so embarrassed. For example, it was a very small store, so we had very limited stock. I mean, he had about three or four different sport jackets. And so if a customer came in, for example, and said, I like this sport jacket, and he'd try it on, and it obviously wasn't his size, right? It was a size or two too big. the owner of the shop would say, "Oh, well, I got your size in the back in the storeroom. I'll go get it." And he took this coat off, and he went in the back, and he was back there. He'd smoke a cigarette, and I would follow him back there to tell him that we don't have that size. And he said, "It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Watch this and learn." He'd go back out, he'd put the same coat on the guy and say, "This is a size smaller, this is your size," and the guy would buy it.
Bruce remembers another moment at the shop that influenced the way he was to forever think about his tastes versus the tastes of others.
A guy came in and he wanted to buy a shirt, so I waited on the guy, and the guy picked out what I thought was the ugliest shirt, not only in the store, but in the whole town. And he said, "Oh, I like this shirt." And I said, "Well," I said, "okay, but," I said, "let me show you something nicer." And I showed him a shirt that I liked. And after about 20 minutes, I sold it to the guy. And I was elated. I was elated. And the owner, his name was John, came over to me. And I said, "Did you see that? I sold that guy a shirt." He said, "Don't ever do that again." And I said, what do you mean?" He said, "Do you understand what you did? You talked the guy out of a shirt he liked, and you took a chance and took a lot of time and effort to sell him something that he didn't want in the first place." He said, "Don't ever do that again. Let the customer have what he wants. It's not up to you."
Before we continue on Bruce's discovery and conversion to Ivy Style, a message from this week's sponsor. This chapter of Unbuttoned is brought to you by Anderson & Shepard. As you'll hear in the next episode, Bruce has been filling his wardrobe with bespoke suits and jackets from Anderson & Shepard for over 50 years.
The reason I like Anderson & Shepard is for the reason I originally went to them. What I liked about Anderson & Shepard was that they're a very soft, easy suit.
As you're hearing in this episode, Bruce has long been a devotee of the softly tailored look, rooted in American Ivy League. But Bruce found the same approach to easy elegance in England, at Anderson & Shepard.
I always really liked that soft, easy look with a little bit of a rumple to it, because I can't carry off, you know, that Prussian general look, you know, like you're wearing aluminum foil or something like that, because I like the comfort.
Anderson & Shepard can be found at 32 Old Burlington Street, London, just around the corner from Savile Row. Or check out their online calendar for international visits from their traveling tailors. That's at anderson-shepard.co.uk. And while there, Anderson & Shepard also has a full range of casual clothes, knitwear, and accessories in their online shop. anderson-shepard.co.uk. Now, back to Bruce's early lessons in style, and one he learned thanks to a jazz icon.
Miles Davis came to Newport in 1956 wearing a zoot suit, and Charlie Davison, the guy who owned the Andover shop in Cambridge, said to Miles Davis, "You can't go on stage here looking like that." And he put him in a sack suit, you know, natural shouldered seersucker. And Miles went on stage. And when he came off, he got rid of his zoot suits. You know, he was such a success. And so did every other jazz musician.
You might not remember this stage of Miles Davis's career after the zoot suits, but before the space suits. It happened when Miles and his band were playing college campuses around the U.S., and he'd see these kids in their Ivy League outfits, and he liked it. So, with Charlie Davidson's help, he was able to stock up on the button-down shirts and soft-shouldered jackets he'd seen. He took what was then a symbol of the white establishment and brought it into the African-American community. And a bit, too, about Charlie Davidson, the 92-year-old is still around, but just retired from the business. And his shop, located at Harvard University, is also still around, still serving up tweeds and button-downs. It was purchased just as Charlie retired by a group of longtime customers, guaranteeing, hopefully, that one of the last bastions of Ivy Style survives well into this century. Bruce himself didn't attend Harvard, but he did attend Moravian College, one of the oldest in the U.S.
I can't say too much in praise of it because it was the making of me.
But what was it like to go to college in the late 50s? And more importantly, for me, what were the other guys wearing?
It was that Ivy League atmosphere where you wore chinos all year round because you could, you know, you could wash them in the sink and hang them out the dorm window to dry, you know. I remember still seeing guys walking around with the old Basswegian penny loafers on, and they had duct tape around them to keep the soles on, that kind of thing, and the old London Fog Balmacan raincoats, you know, which you would just throw over your gym shorts and a sweatshirt to go to class.
Hold on, wait a second. Gym shorts in the classroom? That sounds like what people do today. They did that in the 50s?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, if you had an 8 o'clock class and you were out all night drinking, you know, I mean, you had to get up at, you know, 7:45 and run across the quad to get the class. You know, you'd maybe even just, you'd be in your pajamas and you'd just throw your old wrinkled, dirty London Fog raincoat over your pajamas and jump into your duct-taped Basswegians, and you'd run to class and hope that you didn't fall asleep in class. You know, that you wore a tie on weekends. You didn't wear it to class, but on weekends there would have been dances, there would have been parties, fraternity parties, get-togethers, a date. You would have a date and go to a restaurant, you know, an inexpensive restaurant, or go to a movie, or sometimes on a Sunday afternoon, maybe the dean would invite a couple of students to tea. And that's when you would wear a tie, but you didn't have to wear a tie to class. I think most students, male students that I know, the standard uniform would have been penny loafers and khakis and a button-down shirt and a Shetland crew neck. That would have been the absolutely typical outfit that you would have worn to class during the week, during the day.
Once Bruce graduated, and we can safely assume he wasn't wearing gym shorts under his robes, he went on to do postgrad work. Now it was the mid-60s, and things were really beginning to change in society and the way people dressed.
I would say that up until about 1964 or so, things seemed to be pretty stable, you know, with the Ivy League approach to clothing. And in 1963, or even maybe a little earlier, in this country, we became aware of the British Carnaby Street phenomenon. And then in 1964, the Beatles came here and kind of changed the music and the culture and everything else. And then shortly after that, I mean, I think at that point, young guys started to assume that kind of British Carnaby Street look. And that then within another year or two, they started to assume a kind of hybrid, as the British, in fact, had done, between the Carnaby Street look and a kind of hippie, you know, flower power look. And then, of course, by 1967 and 68, you had the Summer of Love and Woodstock.
Okay. We already know how Bruce feels about the Summer of Love. But just what was the Carnaby Street look? Carnaby Street was a small stretch of hip shops that in the 1960s was the epicenter of the swinging London look. Shops like I Was Lord Kitchener's Valet mixed Edwardian clothing with psychedelic patterns. This was the Peacock Revolution. Collarless Nehru jackets, velvet everything, and tall-heeled boots for guys. Think The Who, The Rolling Stones, and The Beatles in their 60s heydays. And then there was Bruce. a grad student and part-time teacher on campus in the late 60s, in no way a peacock.
I became very, very interested in the New Left during that period. You know, both theoretically and practically. So I would go to campus meetings of faculty members, sometimes students and so forth, about New Left concerns, you know, changes on campus, all sorts of things. Political rallies, in fact, is what they were. And so you can imagine that in the auditoriums and so forth, there was a sea of distressed, studded denim and tie-dyed T-shirts, and one guy wearing a three-piece flannel suit, which was me. At first, I think the students thought I was a spy. You know, it took the longest time for me to convince them by argument that you could have sympathies with the New Left and still wear decent clothing. The assumption was that you had to completely identify with the proletariat. You know, in other words, you had to have long hair and only wash once a month, you know, in order to accept Marxist philosophy, let's say, or to consider it. And so they thought I was odd, but I pointed out to them, because they kept saying, well, you know, you're wearing the uniform of the oppressor, right? And I pointed out that they were wearing a uniform as well, which they didn't like, because they considered themselves all individualists, you know, which included, by the way, any young person whose father could afford to buy them a guitar. They called themselves folk singers.
Before Bruce can tell us more about why he hates folk music, back to the clothes and the then ubiquitous hippie look.
By the time I left teaching, left campus in 1973, I think it was, that look had completely taken over. And The students who were wearing, you know, traditional Ivy League clothes were almost hiding somewhere.
And Bruce was one of them, although he certainly wasn't in hiding. In future episodes, we'll hear his stories of becoming a male fashion writer in the 70s, visits to London's Savile Row, and Italy's finest tailors. But through it all, even until today, he has stuck to his style principles. He has stuck to Ivy League. And he did it because for him, Ivy means comfort and elegance.
Ivy League clothing, of course, started off as something of a Eastern establishment elite, you know, the triple E of dress. But very quickly it came to be the standard because of the ease of wearing it. If you look at 19th century clothing, particularly, let's say, British clothing, which is the history of menswear, what you see is comfort completely being submerged by dignity. You know, Victorian clothing was based upon the idea that one should have a dignified appearance. There should be a certain decorum, a certain propriety, a certain etiquette to dress, which had absolutely nothing to do with comfort. I think America turned that on its heels. This is why, for example, I'm such a big fan of Fred Astaire, because historically, Astaire, I think, and I would argue, was the new man, the new American, who showed everybody that you could have respect and still be completely comfortable. You know, I mean, he wore white tie and tails the way the rest of us wear pajamas. I think that this element of comfort, and that's what the history of 20th century clothing is about, a move towards more and more and more comfort.
Bruce is right, of course. Comfort is king. That's how most people feel about their clothing today. It needs to be comfortable, above all else. But starting in the 60s, for most people to achieve that comfort, the sacrifice they made, the willing sacrifice, was elegance. In many ways, by sticking with Ivy League, Bruce was and is that outlier who says you can have it all. You can look and feel relaxed while also looking sharp and feeling well put together. That's what he's written about for nearly 50 years in a half dozen books like True Style, Eminently Suitable, and the aptly named Elegance. If you haven't already, search them out and give them a read. On the next chapter of Unbuttoned, Bruce's stories from the birthplace of tailoring, London's Savile Row. This podcast is a production of the Hogtown Rake. Thanks for listening.